Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. Joining me around the mic today is Owen Cutts.
Hi.
All right, Owen. Yeah. Owen took a dramatic pause, G'd himself up, bopped up and down, got some energy,
got loose,
and then said hello.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Because, for those that... there's a razor blade on the floor, right? Number one, what the fuck is it doing there?
Yeah.
And number two, it's totally messed up my whole brain. I was just thinking, and then you went Owen Cutts, and I was like, why has he got a razor blade on that? That's all I was thinking. Then I said hello. Talk us through the razor blade.
Well, it's a building site, isn't it? These things happen.
Doesn't mean anything.
It does. It's not your conventional...
I used to work on building sites.
All right,
never had razor blades.
Okay, well, it's not a conventional Gillette, like, cut your face razor blade.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
It's like a
old school... Yeah, in the trap house.
Oh, man, well, I can't even argue because this is the trap house, literally, now. It's been named by Jamali and it's stuck because it's not getting any better. So sorry about that. Uzo's around the mic today. Welcome back to the Stew, Ooze.
All right, mate.
All right. Dane, don't take forever with your dramatic pause.
No. I have to recognise the importance of timing. And also being unique, because it's been done very well on two occasions. So now it's a rule of three.
All right.
I don't want to rinse it. So okay. just me.
Well, you've heard his voice. You should know who that is by now. Joining us for the Stew today is Dane Baptiste.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I guess the razor's to cut the product, Owen. That's what I'd assume, in the trap house.
Me too.
Man. Yeah, to make sure it's poorer.
Yeah.
There's a theme here. I'm actually glad that we're able to talk to you today, Dane, because there was a little fear running through my heart and my head all of about 15 minutes ago, because Owen and myself decided to jump in Uzo's kidnap van to go and get a hot drink.
It's not a kidnap van. It's a consensual sex van. Before, when I bought it.
Yeah,
maybe.
The adjective consensual helps, but a sex van is... is still, you know, as in, it's like a like a rubber bullet. It's still...
still a bullet.
Yeah, it's still a bullet.
It still hurts.
Yeah. Hopefully.
The reason we call it that is because, well, you showed me pictures of this van a little while ago. It's a Transit that you converted into something that could hold your motorbike.
That's right.
And it does lots of other things. You talked us through various sections in it. There's a book section.
Library, I like to call it.
There's a section where you keep your iPad, which you call the... what do you call the iPad section?
Media center.
there's a small cacti in the corner, which you call the...
I don't call it that. You call it the garden.
There's also cookers and all sorts. And I think me and Owen were being extra polite when we essentially humoured you when you talked us through the correct way to house your cutlery inside a van.
Yeah.
Can you explain what the correct way to house your cutlery inside a moving vehicle is? So,
you want to get those metallic strips, you know,
strip magnets.
Oh, the magnets,
yeah. And you want to put them on there, bang on.
Why do you know what a magnet strip is, Dave?
Huh?
Well, you're like, oh, yeah, one of those.
It's not my first sex van I've heard of. It's replete with the usual stuff, as standard.
But who's that? Why is there just knives? Why was there just knives?
No spoons.
No fork. Yeah.
How are you schlucking the oysters, Uzo? In the sex van. And where's the corkscrew for the wine?
Where'd you keep that?
I'm becoming a lot more cynical about this sex van.
Can I just say, so we get out of the back bit where the bed, where the bed is in the garden.
It's a bonquette.
The bonquette. And we get in the front, yeah? That's this. All that's gone before is not confusing. Right? Compared to...
Wait for this.
When we sit in the van, and then we have a little look in the little pocket... There's two kazoos, a triangle, and a fucking cowbell.
Well, that's the studio. That's the percussion, Uzo.
Uzo.
That's where the percussion...
Talk us through the two kazoos, a cowbell, and a fucking triangle.
Why did you have all of that in the driver's cab of the car?
Interactive. All right, sing-alongs. All right, think about road trips. Yeah. Right,
true.
You want to shake a little shaker. Do you know what I mean? Get the shoulders
exactly.
going.
Exactly. You're on your way to... Everyone's on their way to an orgy, and it's like, let's get everyone's spirits up before we arrive. I can't. I don't know if I can mimic a kazoo. How that sounds.
He had two of them.
Two kazoos.
Which sounds like a nice euphemism on a sex van.
You could harmonise kazoos. Like, how often have you seen that in a transit van?
Well, that was going to be our band, wasn't it? Two kazoos in a triangle.
That's what I'm saying.
I like it.
And then you made the mistake of asking, who's the triangle?
Am I the triangle?
This is a dark, dark, dark line of conversation. Anyway, that was our sort of our pre-show, which I think should become a ritual now.
Yes.
Maybe we should jump in the van and see where it takes us.
I like the kazoos. In my head, I see you guys like driving around and it's like the Monkees meets a Benny Hill.
Dave, look, I'm so glad that you're on the stew. Clearly, we're going to have a lot of giggles, but I really want to sort of get into your story, your journey, and what's brought you to this point. As a fan, I was really privileged to watch you do your one-man thing at the Soho Theatre, and you're about to do it all over again, right?
I am, yeah. I'm currently in the middle of tour of my, it's my second tour and my third one-hour show, which is called Gold, Oil and Drugs, which abbreviates to God. And it's basically a show about like worship and idolatry and I guess that's 21st century life kind of thing and the human condition, but very funny. So
if you do say so yourself.
If I do say so myself.
I'll be the judge.
Yeah, you can be the judge. It's comedy, it's subjective.
I really did enjoy that. I'm pissing about, I'm being an idiot. I really enjoyed the show. One of the things I loved about it before you even got on stage was the fact that I was there early, which does happen sometimes, so piss off everyone else in the room. The soundtrack while we were waiting was like straight 90s hip hop. It was Mobb Deep. It was Boot Camp Click. I was like, what the hell is this?
I definitely like to build context before I've even said anything on stage and let people use the soundscape to give people an idea of what they should expect. Because I guess comedy has some parallels with music in terms of you have like, I guess, singles and the shorter form jokes and stuff. And then you have like, I guess your hour show is like your album. Cause then I guess you have a longer form jokes and you're giving people more of an idea of your perspective as well as your ability to make them laugh and stuff as well. So in the same way, I guess, you know, music will stir some emotions and stuff. It's like once the laughter dies down, you still want to leave that impression. So yeah, definitely involved with the soundscape and just giving it an idea of 90s and stuff as well. And also cause the show is called Reasonable Doubts. It's an homage to Jay-Z's debut album.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have the kind of create that 90s soundscape with the show as well.
Wicked.
So I definitely want to work on aesthetic as well as the comedy as well. So once I do have the, I guess, the bones down of the jokes and stuff as well, there's a lot more you can build on.
Love that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to the new show in a little bit. I sort of want to talk about how we met and also the times that we've come into contact with each other that apparently I'm not even aware of.
Yeah.
We'll get to those in a second. Yeah. First of all, we've got a dummy in common.
Yes.
By the way, for those that don't know him,
well done.
That's his name. Dumi is a person. That's just the way I say things. I've mentioned having a Yemi in common before. That's not a euphemism. And a Dumi is not a euphemism either. These are both just Nigerian names. Your lot, Uzo. Your lot. Yeah. Anyway, we have a Dumi in common. You went to school with a friend of mine.
Yes, sir.
And when I first met you on the street, I bumped into him and he introduced us.
Yeah, it was a nice meeting. A little triumvirate of creativity. I went to school with Dumi. We went to ASK together and as time goes on, like, you know, you go to school and you kind of think you don't know what people are gonna get into, but the alumni seem to be like growing and growing and like becoming a lot more successful. So as well as myself, Dumi went to my school.
And for those that don't know, Dumi is he runs Disturb in London. He's Tiny Temper's manager. He's very successful.
Yeah, real successful.
Really inspiring
and,
things.
Yeah, he's been a massive inspiration. And obviously, Sean Wright and Bradley Wright Phillips also went to ASK as well.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. KTB went there a lot after my time though. It's revealing my age. And Ray Spall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ray Spall.
Super talented.
Yeah. There's a lot of good pool of talent and creativity from ASK. And yeah, I've known him for a very long time. And also Richard Lindsay went to ASK.
Okay.
So you remember Richard?
No.
So.
Okay. Did you like my answer though? That was good, wasn't it? Like, you want to know. Okay.
Okay.
Richard. Who's Richard?
So Richard was in my class at school. And I remember him bringing me to a house party when you went by Busy. And it was in Broccoli.
I know exactly the house.
Yeah,
part
behind
you're talking
Broccoli
about.
Barge.
Yeah.
And I think you'd open with a set and then you left and then someone got stabbed, Reggie.
That's how bad he was.
That's how bad he was.
After Reggie had left, no, it was a good set.
Thank you very much.
It was a good set.
Fuck you, Owen.
It was a nice set. Very impressive.
What music was it? Sorry, was it hip hop? Was it
garage? Kind of garage, but yeah. I mean, this is like early days. It was like 4x4, so there wasn't a lot of people that were really doing that much with depth. So I guess to place chronology. It was kind of that period between, I guess, 4x4 and then kind of Heartless and Sticky kind of coming in. So yeah, people, it was becoming a lot more vocally based or lyric based.
Nice. So this is probably late 90s, early noughties.
Yeah.
In Southeast London, I moved here from North London and I was MCing and we were in the same room and you were a reveler.
Yeah.
And I was the entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I wasn't shit.
Well, hey, no, not at all. Someone got stabbed.
Someone got stabbed. But that was something completely unrelated. And I just remember sitting at the table with this guy waiting for the ambulance to arrive.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I mean, like, and I remember being like, that guy busy had a good bar on virginity.
Welcome to my youth, ladies and gentlemen.
I think I was like, why am I still a virgin? And across the table with someone trying to, you know, stem their blood loss, I was like, okay, I guess it could be worse. Just kind of puts into perspective. If I could choose between losing my flower or my spleen, I guess. I can wait for somebody special. It's fine. It's fine.
Have you always lived in Southeast London?
I have, yeah. So born in Greenwich Hospital and then grew up kind of hid the green and Lewisham, and then spent uni, I was out of London. And then I'd spend like most of my summers, or I'd spend a few months apart in like Huddersfield. So my mum first came over from Grenada. So my family's from Grenada originally. So my mum came over, she lived in Huddersfield. And then a lot of Grenadians moved to Broccoli and Crofton Park. So that's where she lived. Then she met my dad here. And so grew up in here, the green. And then just, yeah, knocked around Catford and Lewisham and stuff. And then
proper South.
Yeah, proper South. And then spent some time in uni in Bradford and, as I said, in Huddersfield. And then moved to Brixton for a bit. And then now in North Greenwich. So, yeah, just moved around the South and stuff. Yeah.
I thought he was about to give your like full address there for a second.
Oh,
like,
no.
Well, you've given a lot of information.
Well, yeah, enough information. Because, I mean, really, a large part was at my mum's house. So... You know, unless anyone's planning on like stealing an ottoman and a lot of other stuff she continues to hoard, then, you know, a lot of stuff will do well in this trap house, to be honest.
To be fair, yeah, I need
she could drop some stuff in the trap house if she wanted to.
We had Noel Clark on the show a couple of weeks back, and Noel spoke about growing up in West London, in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea.
Yeah.
And it's a real two ends of the spectrum type borough, where you've got council estates and £6 million houses, and it's pretty much the same thing in Greenwich.
Yeah.
You know, there's really, really affluent streets, and then you've got council properties all over the place.
Yeah.
Being in that environment and growing up in that environment, how much has that tainted, steered, or aided your comedy?
I think it's definitely aided it. I think, especially, like I said, I grew up in Lewisham, the borough of Lewisham, but more specifically here, the Green.
Blue Borough.
Yeah, yeah. So Blue Borough. So it's like, you know, so you definitely had the kind of that kind of mix and being like a lot of council places, a lot of estates and, you know, places like Beeps Estate or Milford with their big sprawling estates and a lot of street activity, so to speak. But then at the same time, I'm very close to Blackheath, which is very affluent. And then like you had, I'm quite close to like Grove Park and I guess the A2. So you kind of had, I guess, aspirational white working class or like or lower middle class as well. And some council properties and some people own properties and stuff. So just being able to be around that many people and guess have such a varied narrative. Because even in a way, like you also had like a kind of, I guess, a black upper working and aspirational class in places like Catford and stuff where people would have had rent to buy properties and stuff or sent their kids to grammar school. So it was definitely a great opportunity to see so many different narratives and interact with so many different people. And it's definitely aided comedy to be able to make valid observations based on actually seeing it rather than a narrative which is just based on hearsay or stereotypes.
Yeah, see, I love what you've done in Sunny D, which we'll get into in sort of greater detail in a little bit. But for those that don't know, Dane writes and leads a sitcom about a family that I guess is based quite largely on your own personal experience.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So with that being the case, how were you able to sort of negotiate the West Indian parents and the world of comedy? Because I imagine the era in which your parents came to this country, you suggesting a life in a world of entertainment and comedy specifically, probably didn't go down too well.
Oh, no, no.
So how do you sort of negotiate that conversation?
It's civil now. That's the response. we're talking again. So that's good. I always say the best analogy is that I had to kind of be in the closet about my creativity. And then come out to my parents as like a creative and a comedian. And then, you know, my dad was like, I guess, as long as you're happy, I guess. If it makes you happy, yes, I don't like it, but whatever. Mom was like, what about a family? So it was like the same thing as like, you know, yeah, I guess when you're coming out, because your mom's like, well, how are you going to have a family if you're going to do this? this lifestyle of yours, will you be out at all times of night, drugs? So, yeah, it was, so I guess it was difficult in that respect, but I kind of tried to hedge my bets by making sure I went to university and stuff. So I was kind of like, you know, I've still got options or something to fall back on. I did a business degree. I have nothing to fall back on. There is no plan B. It's so ambivalent. It might as well have done media studies. I could have done toast buttering. I'd be in the same position. So that was kind of tough. But I guess the same with most. I think it's the experience for most people who are second or third generation immigrants that your parents... there's a comedian called Dimitri Martin, and he kind of had a bit where it was like, I guess skilled workers want their kids to be professionals, and professionals want their kids to be involved in something legal or clerical or medical. And then people in those professions want their kids to be scholars. Scholars want their kids to be artists, and artists don't care what their kids are. And then I think if you come from a certain background and you want to be involved in creative, it's like you're skipping a few steps. So yeah. I guess that's where the difficulty comes from. So yeah, I guess there was that adversity there, but it's, so far as the journey's been difficult, but it's paying off now. And now I guess they have a visual representation of me being more successful. So it's been fine in that respect. But I guess I told myself from the beginning, like, you know, they're not going to like it, but at some point you're responsible for your own life. So
yeah. Uzi, you come from a Nigerian background. When you decided that you wanted to have a life in photography, were your parents fuming, or were they just relieved because you turned the corner? Because the Uzo that you see today, ladies and gentlemen, is very different to the Uzo that was growing up in southeast London.
Back when man had a van and a provisional license. A sex van and a provisional license.
A hand-paid UPS on the side of his van.
And one kazoo. Just one kazoo, you know. It was different out there.
Uzo did say before when you were late, Uzo did drop some stuff on me about his growing up.
About his past.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, shit. Really?
Who?
You. Go on, Uzo.
Well, all right, skipping all that stuff. It's for a different podcast.
This is for Owen's violence podcast.
Violence podcast.
This is the thing, by the way. I don't know if you've heard about this thing, but Owen's about to start his own spin-off podcast called Violence.
Violence and knives.
Where you can come on and talk about getting glass in the face. Yeah. Nice.
Eight knives one time in a kazoo.
I just smashed him in the face.
See you next week.
Anyway, we'll save the full details of that for Violence with Owen Cutts.
It's funny because I was thinking about what you were saying, and I thought to myself, man, I would have loved that response. Because when I said that, Mum, I was thinking of maybe... I said to my mum, I was thinking maybe I'm not going to be a doctor. What if I'm an optician? Because if I'm an optician, I can work 9 to 5. I can still do the boxing. I can still do the photography. Mm-hmm. And she literally kicked me out of the house.
Damn. Just by suggesting it.
Yeah, that's crazy. Homeless.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the burden for a lot of the children of first generation immigrants. It's legal, clerical, medical, or like maybe, I guess, finance or failure. Yeah. Although there is one anomaly, because I was saying, like, because most West African parents might be, if you're not a doctor, then you're a failure. But there's probably one field of medicine where they wouldn't be, if you were a vet. I feel like if you're like, I want to be a doctor, of course, of animals. What? What?
So true. Yeah. So true.
What?
For what?
You want to give cats surgery for cats? Leave.
So how about now then, Ooze? Are they accepting? Because you're a successful photographer.
They only care about when you're successful. They're like, oh, so you know famous people. Right? Everything's fine now.
Yeah, and everything's fine now.
Everything's fine.
So have you turned a corner with your parents and their perception of what it is you do? You're on TV. You've got your own show. You do the Apollo on a regular basis. I mean, the Apollo looks impressive. When you walk out and there's smoke and there's lights and
thousands of people.
Thousands of people. Your mum must see that and go, oh, he's done well.
I mean, yeah. Although it's like... Why are you using profanity? You know, your family can see this. So,
right.
I feel like that's always been the state, is that parents, I guess they're never really satisfied. And they'll always have that fear in terms of like, if you have, they want you to have a family and they want you to have a kid and you have a kid, it's like, well, just one. So, I mean, they're never satisfied. So it's I guess that's keeps you on your toes and I guess striving to kind of validate yourself, knowing full well it's going to be futile, but it keeps you going. Yeah, they've been fine, man. But I'd say, you know, in my dad's case, his only real stipulation just in how I live my life was just, you know...
Use a condom.
Yeah, use a condom. Don't lie, cheat or steal and just be of someone who's, you know, with a name that all have some integrity. So just no one can say anything about your name. So he kept it very flexible in that respect. And, you know, my dad actually helped me out. Financially, I did my debut show in Edinburgh, which is not cheap. It's expensive to put on a debut show. And I was just a bit short after, like, I was doing, and I was literally doing the whole cliche, like, birthdays and Christmases and weddings and stuff to raise money for Edinburgh. And then luckily got a voiceover. And then just the outstanding I had, my dad basically stumped up the money. And, wow. You know, this is, I remember, and he had spent some time in hospital and was kind of like, you're probably getting to an age where if you really need to get a house and think about family and give you a deposit, I was like, I've got a better idea. I'm going to go tell jokes for an hour every day in Scotland and spend August in the only part of the world where there's no sun. Can I have some money, please, father? And the rest is history. So, yeah, so I guess my dad's... And my mom's been supportive as well in that, you know, she didn't kick me out. Even though she wasn't approving. So I guess, yeah, been able to enjoy some free rent while I was beginning my early creative pursuits was massively beneficial, especially where I know a lot of my other peers and contemporaries do struggle. So even though they may have not been vocally supportive, I guess, you know, actions speak louder than words.
See, it's such a broken record, but there's definitely a theme here. And I'm interested to hear what you experienced, though, and when you made that decision that being creative was what your future was going to look
totally
like.
Because, opposite.
Right, well, Uzo went through, he got kicked out. You had a slight clash, but they ended up supporting
you.
I ended up having to have the entire family sit down, all the elders sat around, and decided that I was going to be allowed to do what I wanted to do for one year.
An intervention.
Yeah,
almost like an intervention.
Wow. Basically, it was all the elders sat around because my parents said, no, you can't act and present for a living. Mm-hmm. Even though I've been doing it for 10 years at this point and had a career. Yeah. Let me just make this a little bit more clearer, right? This is how ridiculous it gets. I also had an offer for 1 year at One Extra, right? Mm. I also had an offer for 1 year on Top of the Pops, and I had an offer for 1 year on CBBC.
Where they got the 1 year thing from?
Well, basically, I had three annual contracts in my hands, and my mum and stepdad said, nope. You're going to go in and get an education. And I was like, but I've got like, do you understand how much this is? This is more than the two of you earn times three. Yeah. This is incredible. Can I not do this? And they were like, nah. And then we ended up having the entire family and amazing. All the elders sit down. And wow. I was given 1 year.
How old are you?
I was 18.
Wow.
That's when all of that happened. So it seems like there's a theme here. And we're all, you know, the products of immigrant families. Owen, for you and your family, what did you experience?
Totally opposite. Couldn't have been more opposite.
Go on.
Like, honestly, I think I could have recorded me farting and put it on SoundCloud, and my mum and dad would have been over the moon. They would have been, oh my God.
It sounds like
published.
He's published. He's controlled his flatulence. I'm so proud of him. That's sphincter control.
No, but he's managed to record it. He's recorded it. It's up. It's on the internet. You can listen to it. And they would have fucking... My dad would have burnt it on CD and put it in the files.
That's my son. Those are whale sounds for me. Yeah. That's how I sleep. Proud of you. Damn proud of you,
son. I'm telling you, man. Like, sometimes I'm not like... I feel bad saying this because your guys' stories are so... sort of heartbreaking, but I sometimes don't tell my parents some of my achievements.
Really?
Yeah, because they're so fucking over the top with their like it's pride.
It's cringy.
And it's just kind of like my mum's there going like, oh, oh my God. Like getting played on radio or whatever, or writing us all like, I don't know, man. It's just so opposite. So like.
Did you tell him when Zane Lowe played your record on Radio 1?
Yeah, my dad has it burnt on CD.
Nice. Nice.
My dad has it burnt on CD.
Does he prefer the farts or?
The farts is a side project.
One of the things that I'm fascinated about when it comes to this creative conversation is that moment when you sort of decide this is what I'm going to do. Or, you know, you get that moment of inspiration. Yeah. I have a very clear moment in my head when that happened for me. You're nodding, Dane. What was that for you?
Like I said, it's like I've seen yourself like go from emceeing in a room to like, be on TV and radio.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of seeing anybody because I had no idea how to pursue it because my sisters went to like dance school and they would do like jazz and tap and ballet and modern. But for me, I had never really seen a clear path, especially in this country, so far as pursuing any creativity. Obviously, this is like pre-internet and stuff. So it wasn't like you could Google any inquiries you had.
Right.
So it was just seeing anybody. Like even I remember like going to like All Dayers at like Brockwell Park and stuff and seeing like dancers like pop locking and stuff. So for me, it was anyone that was any kind of artistic expression I found like really inspiring. But I guess for me, the light bulb came. I went to Broadway Theatre in Catford to watch a comedy show with my friends, and I was 15, and we saw D.L. Hughley, Leo Muhammad from Real McCoy, and Russell Peters. Russell Peters, who's probably arguably the largest like circuit stand-up in the world, and he was the opening act. But I remember seeing him, and like Russell Peters does a lot of immigrant-based comedy because he's from Toronto, and he was talking about like a friend's dad from St. Vincent, and the fact that Caribbean parents confuse singular and plural nouns. So they'd be like, "You want a sweets? You want a sweets? You want a sweets? Four sweets." And I was like, it's exactly what it's like. Exactly. Exactly. And I just found it hilarious. And I was just seeing that at 15. And I was like, so this is what it is. This is how you do it. Because I liked making jokes. And I had a class clown complex. And I liked doing that. But I just didn't know what to call it. And I'd seen stand-ups. But I'd seen it more in an incarnation of like Hayden Pace doing like sketch. And, you know, or seeing like Victoria Wood and having like musical numbers. And seeing like French and Saunders. And then the Real McCoy. But seeing actual stand-up, that's when the penny dropped for me. And then that same year, my friend's mom had been to America and she'd bought audio comedy. So we had Bigger and Blacker and Voodoo Child by Eddie Griffin.
Wow. And just to, Bigger and Blacker, Chris
Rock,
right?
Yeah, Chris Rock, yeah, just to listen to them. And for me, it was like, that's then when it solidified. And I was like, that's what I want to do. And I guess, yeah, and I just repressed it because I didn't know I had to see it in the UK and stuff. And it was like, I enjoyed doing that. And it was actually, I have a twin sister and my twin actually wanted to be on TV and she wanted to be a presenter and she did like, I remember MTV Select had like a competition for presenters and stuff and so she used to enter that and subscribe to stage. And I guess as twins, then I probably rebelled against more. I was like, if that's what she wants to do, then I'm going to go the lateral corporate path instead. And this was, and like I said, I was just in denial about who I was and just stayed in the closet as a creative. And as time went on, I just couldn't really hold it in anymore and just got to the point where I was just like, do you know what? You know, it's around just like 2007, 2008. It's like had a credit crunch now. So even a stable job is not stable anymore. And the idea of people going to work in order to pay into a pension, that's no longer stable. So after years of trying to rationalize these dreams, I was like, well, you know, why don't you just try something you enjoy? At least it doesn't work out. You can go back to a desk and or a 9-to-5 and have that life. But you might as well. There's nothing to lose now.
Did you have a light bulb moment, Uz?
Yeah. I got to the point, so after I told my mom I wanted to be an optician, got kicked out, became an optician, and then...
Hang on, you became an optician?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I used to be an optician.
There's so much I don't know about you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Surprise.
Surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
So I got into optics for a while, but because I...
Got into optics? Yeah, yeah.
For a while?
Got into optics
for a while?
What? Were you like Donald H. or something? What were you? Specsavers?
Like it was the French horn. I tried it.
Yeah. No, I'm going to it for a while. Yeah.
No, so,
what, don't like corneas. I'm boring.
Where you using eye-based humour?
I love it.
You got him.
He got it, right?
So were you working in an optician's in an actual shop or were you just
I worked in Arthur Hayes Opticians in Croydon. Big up. And and then part time I went to uni, and then the quick story was basically I had to buy a house because kept on getting into crap with landlords and stuff, and I was young and I was frustrated, so I thought, fuck it, I'm buying a house. And then I worked on the house, and then I thought, wait a minute, when I sold the house I made so much money, I'm like, I'm going to do this for a while. So I did property for a while, left optics, and then I was like, I'm a young person and you do all the stupid stuff that young people with from the hood do, you buy a range and all that kind of crap. And then you go, I'm not happy. So I thought, I'm going to be an artist. I decided. And I thought, musician or photographer. Literally flipped a coin and picked photography.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Wow.
So that, you could have been a musician. That could have happened.
Yeah. Owen and I were just talking about like my classical guitar.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed.
He literally was, we were having coffee and he was like, well, the thing is, I can play Gymnopédies 3 on Spanish guitar like to a pretty high level. I was like, what? I don't know if you've heard Gymnopédies 3, but it's like a proper classical guitar tune. Grade eight.
Can we also go back to the part when you were like, I left being an optician to go to uni? How does that go in that order?
What?
Like, are you like the catch me if you can guy? That's like lying your way through.
Oh, yeah, crazy polymath. Yeah. Crazy polymath. And he was like, I could check those eyes for you. This ID looks kind of dubious. I'm an optician, so I could check for your eyes for you. So, anyway, when's Freshers Week?
Well, we've been referring to
when's Freshers Week. I'm here now.
So that's Uzo, can I hear your this one or this one? Can we do that? Well, can you see the X with this one or this one? Go on, bro.
How about now? Better or worse?
Yeah, better or worse.
That's good. I trust you.
Better or worse? When's Freshers Week?
That's good.
We've been referring to you as the Black Milk Tray since the beginning of this. And now it's becoming even more apt as a moniker. You are the Black Milk Tray, man. Like, you. Be honest.
My cheeks are
at here. Some point, did MI5 approach you?
Hey, you
no, can, no, I'm joking.
You can say MI5. No, they're domestic. If it was MI6, then yeah. I could understand the need for secrecy.
You're 00 status.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's where the retinal scan comes from in other films. Yeah. We use the Uzo system here.
Have you been Uzo'd?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, me too.
He's not in optics anymore.
In the van.
Can we trust him, Uzo? Yeah, he has the pupils of a trustworthy person.
That's... Whoa, man.
What was your light bulb moment, though?
I didn't have one. Because, like I said, I grew up in a house. I just say that my parents are creatives. So it wasn't like they were, it wasn't a shock to them that I wanted to, and my sister wanted to be something creative. So we just grew up in it. And we, and like my dad had, mum and dad would have parties and all their actor friends would be there and you'd be there and there'd be musicians and music. And it was always just full of creative. It would almost be weird if I said to them, guys, I want to be a doctor. I'd probably have the same reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd be like, Owen, are you sure?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it was acting or it was music or whatever. Like, I used my dad had a studio in the house. I used that to
I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yes.
How many kazoos? Nice.
Two.
Bang off.
You don't need more than two, do you?
You don't, well said.
Dane, how do you go from having your light bulb moment to being in Edinburgh, getting support from your family, to ending up on TV? I mean, that's a big old jump from doing a show that your father is helping to pay for.
Well, myself, I gave comedy a try before that, and I kind of was winging it, and I did a couple of gigs before I was went back to doing a 9-to-5, and it was around 2010 where I just left my job and was like, if I'm going to do this, and I was seeing some of how my peers were progressing, it was like, well, the first thing you need to have is consistency and just persist with chasing gigs and chasing work, because I'd seen it, but I wanted to know how to do it. So I was like, I should probably hedge my bets and try and get taken as much information as I can. And I did the whole procrastination journey. So I looked on the storylines of the Wikipedia of other comics that I looked up to, and then you kind of look at their journey and read a few autobiographies here and there. And I guess what I found was the commonality was that, you know, you had Russell Brand had gone to Italia Conti and Dave Chappelle had gone to Duke Ellington. And I was starting to see, like, you know, people like these guys are, I would say, they're naturally funny and they have the aptitude for comedy. But so far as achievement, they have studied the art form as well, I guess, dramatic or comedic performance. So I did a creative writing course at the London College of Journalism in Maida Vale, just getting the practice of writing very regularly. And then from there, ended up doing an improv course. And I spoke to the guys that run that course and I said, you know, I'd had some comedy aspirations before and dabbled, and they were like, well, how often were you doing it? And I was like, well, once every blue moon. They were like, well, if you're going to take this seriously, you need to actually study. So I did like a comedy course, which doesn't really teach you how to be funny, but it was just teaching you about the structure of putting a joke together and, you know, your stagecraft and delivering, and even small things like you watch a comic like Frank Skinner on TV, and he's a raconteur and he can stop for a drink because he's learned that timing for years of experience. And you find a lot of new comics kind of do that as well. But when you have 5 minutes on a lineup of 20 other people where you're trying to distinguish yourself and stand out from a roster that big, then you don't really have time to drink. And it was learning small things like that in terms of delivering your craft at the beginning that I needed to learn. So at the end of that, you had a small showcase for everyone that attended this course. And they gave us just a list of open mics around London. And that's when it kind of started, about 2011. Just started hitting the open mic circuit. And, and then you progress. And like I said, it's very similar to music in that you start off with your five-minute set, which is almost like your single. And I guess you're working towards this hour and doing your album and kind of trying to generate a fan base or a taste for your material in the meantime. And my local comedy club was up the creek in Greenwich. And so I used to go there, and I used to see it across the road and think, I want to go there one day and check it out. And they had a new act night, so I used to go down there a few times. And the way it used to work is they'd have like maybe 12 people, and then whoever won that night or runners up would go through to another round, and they would have a competition at the end. And the guys that ran it, Polly and Gelly, would basically garner talent scouts or agents from the industry to come down and say, like, this is the new breed of people we feel we're representing, a new voice in comedy, so check these guys out. And then what used to happen is that I didn't win the competitions, but I was a runner-up and then kept being a runner-up. So I'd never go through. And then Geddy basically was like, you keep coming this close, tell what I'm going to do. Because the prize was you get a professional gig on the Friday. Mm. So Thursdays was like new act night. And then Friday, they'd have the professional nights on the weekend. And they'd have the opening acts. And then in between, they have the open spot, which is like acts auditioning to try and get into regular rotation at these clubs. So you do like a 10-minute set. So Geddy was kind of like, well, I'll give you 10 minutes and see how you do on a professional night. And it went well. And I did that for a few years. And Polly, who at the time was working in production, would invite like people from industry to come down. And no one was really that interested. And I didn't really mind, because at the time I was just like, I just really want to be in a situation where my mother doesn't think I'm a failure. So if you just work out where I can actually just get paid work, I'd be fine. And continue to play that club and other clubs and just nurture your, I guess, your relationships with the promoters and people that run individual nights and also other comics, because they run nights as well, just to give themselves more stage time. So you're just trying to build up your network of a circuit, so to speak. And then, yeah, I just remember saying quite flippantly to Polly and Gelly, who ran The Creek, I was just like, you guys can manage me. I mean, a manager is someone who can just have conversations with other people, make stuff happen. I just want to focus on creating more material and becoming a better act. And yeah, the three of us started Up The Creek Comedy, and which became UTC Artist Management. And yeah, just went from a husband and wife outfit to being like, you know, a fully established artistic agency. Yeah, and in the space of 3 years, I went from kind of like being a relative unknown, going up to Edinburgh for the first time, to yeah, ending up doing, yeah, hosting Live at the Apollo in the space of like just under 3 years.
That's insane.
Wow. So yeah, and it turns out I got nominated for Best Newcomer in Edinburgh with my debut show and became the first black Briton to ever be nominated.
Heavy.
And wow. And it just changed the, and just, and yeah, and I'd like to think kind of changed the landscape of Edinburgh, because it, I guess that looked, again, as they say, that people found it more viable to go to Edinburgh and kind of realise their ambitions. And it showed, I guess, a lot of agencies and people in the industry that actually having a black act is bankable and it's viable, because now as a nominee, so conversation about diversity became a lot more prominent in comedy than it had been before.
Apollo's a big stage.
It's
and
a big stage.
And a scary stage, I imagine. Like walking out on that stage in front of that many people must be difficult. And, you know, I've watched you on TV and on the internet absolutely kill it in there. Have you, no names necessary, you ever seen anybody completely die on that stage in front of a crowd that big?
I have seen it, yeah. I've seen it, but I mean, the person probably being good humor wouldn't mind me saying it, but I don't necessarily need to say it because I've bombed as well. I feel like, you know,
on that stage?
Not on that stage, but
okay then.
It doesn't feel any better or worse.
Not
a, a bomb is still a bomb. Like, silence sounds the same, doesn't matter how the size of the room. So
what's the first, I mean, the first time that happened?
For me?
Yeah, first time ever.
The first time I bombed, it happened so badly that it probably hardens my skin to bomb in future, but...
Well, please explain.
I'm happy happened? To, because I would never forget it. That's what I mean, it's years ago, but...
Do you, do you remember the joke?
Oh, God, yeah, I remember the whole thing. I remember the whole thing.
Can I just clear up, is bombing one joke goes badly, or is bombing the whole show
goes badly? Oh, the whole show goes badly.
Okay, so bombing is like no one laughs at all.
At all. Or you can get booed off stage. Oh, so both things happened to me, Owen.
Jesus.
Both things happened to me. It was a bloodbath. Because the first thing you want to do when you do comedy is that you're trying to prove you're funny. So if you're saying stuff and people laugh, and then some people make the mistake of, oh, so I've proven I'm funny, so I've just got to say the things and deliver the lines, and then people laugh. But this is why I said that 5 minutes is that you having a radio single is so that you can rehearse it and you get better delivering that vocally and people associate with you. And for any reason, if you are starting to learn stagecraft and you're like, hey, crowd, make some noise, you can go back to the song because you know it. Whereas if you start, okay, this is going well, now I'll start showboating, is when you're going to have problems. And it was just the error that I made. That I was like, oh, I've proven I'm funny. Just need to keep writing this new material that's poignant social commentary and people who enjoy it. Not knowing. Yeah. Mistake. Because you can control what you say and stuff in comedy, but it's like any other performance. There are a lot of other elements involved. It's like a chemical reaction. Like if the pH is wrong or the humidity in a lab is wrong, then you can't conduct the experiment. And same with comedy. If the, you know, if the mic isn't right or the ceilings are too high or, you know, the audience aren't sitting near the front, it's very hard to build the kind of atmosphere. However, in this particular instance, the problem was it was a mixed bill night. Now, a mixed bill night means that the tempo of the show and therefore the audience's energy can change in terms of what they're seeing. So they would have rappers and people doing grime and stuff. And this was around the time, like, so Big Nasty was doing Double L with L. Man and Boya DeMarco and New Brand Flex were doing like Gash by the Hour. So kind of that time. And
this is a long time ago.
It's a long time ago, yeah.
Early noughties.
Yeah, yeah. So this is why I kind of like took a break. So to work out what I'm doing with my act. So these guys have gone on first. So like I said, the energy is already different to my style.
So a grime act was first.
Several grime acts were first.
Oh, God.
Several grime acts were first. the point where a grandma who I won't mention, but he was just like, yeah, obviously man don't care about school and that, innit, yeah, but like that's your business, yeah, man don't do books and that, my man gets money, so they're already resentful of that somewhat. And it's at Bruno Uni in their auditorium, where, and it's a mixed school, so what they've done is like, it's like they're having a party, like a, and so there's gonna be an after party after the show. So it's not everyone at this show is studying there.
Yeah.
Some people have just showed up for the after party. It's like, oh, there's going to be girls there. Yeah, obviously, we're all coming in. Like, I'm just going to sort out my tag and that, and then I'm coming. Like, these are the conversations that are being had before people get up there. So I'm way down in this lineup because I'm coming after work. And there's like a fashion show. There was a fashion show.
Oh,
and, then like poets and stuff. I'm serious. Like a fashion show, poets. A-Dot was there.
Okay.
She was still rapping then. That's how long ago this was.
Yeah.
So A-Dot was still rapping and she did a bit. It's fine. So everyone's just doing their thing. So after, and it's like, so this girl's finished speaking and she's like, men, the womb destroyed by them. Women have suffered. When will the womb be free from the mother of earth? Isis. Mother Isis destroyed. Gaia. Thank you. Click, 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 click. So then the host comes back on. He's like, who's ready for comedy? The response, no one. Anyway. This guy's come all the way from South London. Welcome to the stage. I didn't hear this, but he's like, please, we're being as tepid as possible. Please welcome to the stage with about 10% of your love, Dave Baptiste. And this is in inverted commas, a urban gig, which means it's following kind of the same, I guess, sensibilities like Def Jam, like you get the intro music and stuff. And normally kind of things, people show up and it's like, you do a little dance and I didn't grow up on comedy like that. And also because I don't want to come on stage and dance. That's not my job. I'm coming to tell you jokes. And also, by then, I'm almost 30 years old. I don't want to come on stage and be like, hey, I'm about it. Shuck and jive. All right. So I walk on. And it's always suspicious because I'm like, because that's normally what happens. But they're not playing any music. And I'm like, that's, why am I? Why is no one playing music for you? And then the DJ's like, I'm like, we've never met. Why is he angry with me? I'm thinking, I'm sure I recall flushing the toilet. I don't know where's this tension coming from? So I come on the stage, but the thing is, so there's an after play. So they've had enough now because I was tired by the fashion show. So everyone's like, oh, this is long, bruv. Like, when can we leave, man? Like, girls and that, bruv. Hey, who wants to hear some intellectual social commentary? Nobody, bled. Obviously, shut up. So it begins and it's cold. And I start to kind of win them back. And well, not win them, like, yeah, because it's uphill. So I'm starting to get there and it's going okay. I'm at 2-3 minutes in. Then I'm doing a bit on like relationships and stuff. These guys are showing up to meet girls. Me talking about how men can be like dogs. Probably not the best material. Again, school era. So
they're there to dance to
They're there to dance and to meet girls. And I am the biggest cock blocker on campus right now in a full auditorium of me being like, before you go and being able to like satisfy your carnal desires, who wants to hear about what it's like growing up as a third generation immigrant? No one, bro. So I carry on. So and then in the back it's just like, boo! Like, boo! And so then people already have built up a defense where they're like, what's this guy thinking? Well, who do you think he is walking on stage thinking he's funny, yeah? The audacity of this guy, bruv. Come to tell jokes. Well, try to bring joy in our lives. Who does he think he is? He don't know me. This is so people just get very defensive. Like, he was there for some comedy. Nothing's a joke in the streets, fam. Are you mad? What are you doing? The streets aren't a joke. What's this brother making jokes for? So I'm just giving you this background because I can feel this tension is building and building. And then the girl's like, oh, just leave him. Give him a chance. Now, they've come for these girls who I have now won the hearts of just by trying to do something. So then it's like,
Game over.
And people have been booed. And you've heard of people booing. What you've never seen is boo beginning to condense into a visible gas and then into a liquid, which begins to drip all over my body. And I'm just getting booed off stage and the lights are getting brighter. And it's like I said, there's talking and there's rudeness and there's ignorance stuff. Boo! For a whole auditorium. Boo! Dead, bruv. Boo! Please pass the mic. That's a chant in the entire auditorium.
Oh, my God.
Please pass the mic. To the point, I'm like, okay. And then the girls are like, come on, just give him a chance. Which, as you all know, when someone's getting beaten up and the girl goes, no, leave him. I love him. Well, you love him. That's going to make me stop this display of alpha dominance. No, it's not. They're going to get worse. Get him off stage. Waste man. Boo! Boo! So Kojo comes on stage and saves my life.
Was he hosting?
No! He wasn't even hosting! I think he was gonna do a set. He comes on, he's just like, oh, you know, like new guys are trying it, like give people a chance, like, you know, just do it, just give it a chance. And then I don't know if you remember Jamie Howard.
Yeah.
No, Jamie was doing a set as well. Jamie comes on. See, and Jamie,
wait, so hang on a second. Two other comedians came on stage
and Willis,
to save
and another guy, Willis, Will Smith, who he's a filmmaker and he was doing comedy as well. So they were just on after me. See, but what they did is that they knew what kind of crowd there was because they got there earlier. And that's another thing I learned because it's an amazing learning experience. Sometimes you've got to read the room. And sometimes, like, you know, you have to, if you're dealing with lowest common denominator, like people that are there for girls, then you have to start with that. And then maybe you can take them on a journey to elevate their consciousness. But you can't open with stuff that you don't know if it works because you've not tried it out. So that's, I had already made that mistake. So Jamie just went on, and like very cool Jamie Howard to the stage, opened his legs, did his dirty wine, crowd went nuts. So as I'm backstage, standing there in my own, covered in boo, and standing in a puddle of my own self-esteem, the girl from the poet from before goes, I just think where you went wrong is that you mentioned the word fuck, and girls don't want to hear that, and maybe if you weren't so rude in your behaviour, then you may have done better. And I'm like, okay, fine. Next, like, who's on stage next? New Burn Flicks, we get gushed by the, oh, what? Crowd goes crazy, panties, hats going in the air. I'm like, hold on, I thought people don't want to hear the word fuck. It's like, gushed by the hour, yeah? All right, I see where this
it's a good
is.
Song to
it was, yeah, it's a great song. It's a great song. But, I mean, it's about sex, just so spoken word didn't have anything to say about that, though, did she? So, yeah, it just went terribly, and so badly. I mean, I was too ashamed to even ask to be paid for that gig.
That sounds like it was hell on earth.
It was hell on earth.
So how about the moment when you were on the other side of the coin, where you were the successful comedian who knew how to control the crowd and somebody else came on and died?
I got it. Because it's like, I guess you got to think about the game and not the gig. And, you know, and there's a way you can avoid bombing if you say what everybody wants to hear. And you can definitely pander to a crowd and you can play it very safe. And I've seen that with a lot of scenes and a lot of comedy where, I mean, I guess, and I can understand why you're afraid for that reaction. Mm. But it was the conversation I had with Kojo, actually, on the way home, because he dropped me back to Charing Cross.
He felt that bad for you.
Oh, hell yeah. He was like, and he's like, you know, that happens, and you're not a real comic unless you bomb, man. And he was like, you don't want to go out there and say what they want to hear. You're supposed to tell them what you think. And once you learn, you can be like, oh, that was crap. But it's just that self-awareness is a big part of you making observations. So, and another comic who was working on the comedy course I did, Mr. C, and he was like, the first thing you have to learn in comedy is to be able to laugh at yourself. Because if you can't do that, when they do call out something on you, you deal with a heckle and you're not prepared for it, then it's going to just destroy any foundations you're based on.
Comedy is such a fine art. It's interesting that you mentioned Kojo, because we were super close for quite a few years.
In fact,
we actually went to New York together for the first time when he did the New York circuit.
And the Mighty Truck of Fun, I've read that Wikipedia about a million times. So I was like, oh, it could work, maybe.
Mighty Truck of Stuff is a show that, funnily enough, me and two of my mates actually created with Endemol and Kojo. I brought on as a co-host on the show.
Nice.
So we go back a long way. And he's had a long-standing history of putting his arm around new comedians. And
definitely.
Always have and always will take my hat off to
first gig
to
I ever did was at October Funhouse. 26th, 2006, Kojo's Funhouse.
I might have even been there.
Yeah, first one put me on, man. Yeah, it was a good show. And it was crazy as well because like all my friends from school turned up and I was like, what's everyone doing here? It's like, who just came down and randomly? And it's like, that was the first time I was ever on stage. And so Kojo put me on. And basically my friend Alwyn, knew Kojo because they did like after parties and stuff, and he was like, my friend Dane's pretty funny, can you hook him up? And Kojo's like, cool, give you 5 minutes, 2 weeks to get the show together.
That's amazing.
So yeah, so he hooked up my first show. So yeah.
Comedy Funhouse was a moment, man.
It was great, man.
I saw Chris Rock perform there. We're talking about Cork's Wine Bar. Yeah. Just off of Bond Street.
Cork's Wine Bar.
Yeah. So Kojo used to put on this thing called Comedy Funhouse. I saw Dave Chappelle perform there.
I think I was there for that one.
Right.
I saw that. Yeah,
and he had a cigarette. There was no smoking. He had a cigarette and he was just freestyling. And it's just a room full of people our age that were like, at the time we were like in our early to mid 20s.
Yeah.
And Dave Chappelle was performing. This is after Chappelle's show. So this was during the hiatus as well.
Yep.
And he was just, you know, just working out some material.
It came out, man.
And Kojo did that.
Yeah, fine. Like, trust me, like one thing, like initially, as I recall, like for all the big acts that come over from the States and stuff, and other people started promoting comedy shows and stuff, but Kojo was definitely the linchpin between the States and the UK, so far as like, I guess, African-American and urban comics. Yeah, definitely. Because so for African-American comics that came over here and like, you know, but like Chappelle's show, he was still not that known in the UK unless people kind of knew about like Chappelle's show or a real big comedy fan. So yeah, Kojo was always, the point.
Like, that's amazing that he put his arm around you too, man. That man,
definitely.
That man's connected to a lot of people. To bring things right up to date, Sunny D. Mm-hmm. It's your sitcom.
Yeah.
It's the thing that so many people that have been in comedy or been in entertainment or been in television have all dreamed of having. Even if you're just a fan, like at one point, I'm sure we all watched Fresh Prince and wished that we were the Prince or Carlton. Uzo, you wished you were Carlton, right?
Oh, you know me too well.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Owen, Ashley Banks.
You know me too well.
We all wish that we had our own sitcom at one point. I was convinced that I would be Keenan and or Kel at some point during my life. Yeah. And I even got the chance to do it with, I can't remember it, The Crust, which was a sitcom that we had on CBBC. But it was never quite like the thing that we all looked up to.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Whereas Sunny D, on the other hand, your sitcom, it's about your family. It's super smart. There is so much hip hop in it. Yeah. I don't know how you got that all signed off. But you have this show that is essentially your voice.
Yeah.
How do you make that show? How does that happen? And how proud of it are you?
I'm very proud of it. And I think it's like everybody, there's so much stuff you want to cram into what is potentially, I guess, a vanity project, so to speak. And, you know, you're able to tell your story. And it's a very rare opportunity that a lot of people get. So for it to happen, I'm very proud. And I was doing my second show in Edinburgh when they came and told us. So Polly is my manager who previously worked in production. So far as helping me write a structured script, she was massively helpful in that. Because I'd written sketches for TV, but I'd never written a sitcom or had any previous experience in screenwriting. So it was just about how to get these jokes and learn about dialogue and stuff and kind of learn a new discipline. Yeah, the experience was kind of great. And it was just like, if the opportunity ever came up, then, you know, I'd want to make sure I included as much content, as much influence, and as much, I guess, indicators for culture as possible. And I guess, like I said, it's just one of these dreams everybody has. It's like, if I ever got the chance to tell my story, this is what I would do.
Yeah.
So when I was putting together like mood boards and ideas and stuff, Everybody Hates Chris would have been involved, Desmond's, even Kung Fury, which is like a crowdfunded film I've seen online. That was kind of a massive influence, Scorsese film. So like, you know, Scarface. So anything that was had been an influence up until that point, I wanted to make sure it was reflected in the show. And
how did your family react? Because you've got a twin sister in it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she was kind of like, oh, why you keep doing fat jokes? I'm not fat. I work very hard on my weight and exercise. And I was like, it's not actually you. Who cares? Like, you're famous for doing no work, as usual. So why do you care? I've done everything for you. You just got to walk out and enjoy the fame. And then probably betray me in a double page spread. You know, I gave Dane his first biro. Do I get any money? Like that kind of. She'd probably do that. But no, my family were cool. They were super supportive. And some of them were like, are you going to do us or don't make us look that way and stuff? But everyone was kind of in, like, as far as family stuff, they were very embellished or like composite characters that people could kind of project onto and see like similar to their own relatives. But yeah, my family, by that point, they were massively supportive and most people were. And so really the task was, I just wanted to make a good project. And I think at the time, industrially, there was kind of this real issue about how, I guess, marketing to what was the Holy Grail, which is supposed to be like heterosexual men from like 18 to 30 and stuff. And it's only shows for them outside of like Match of the Day that was for them. However, I just kind of felt like I didn't want to make a show which was kind of working within any quantitative methods. Like it's just this demographic or trying to build this demographic.
You just want it to be good.
Just want it to be good. Yeah. It'd be my life and people can really react to different parts of it. So far as the soundscape and the music, like that probably won't happen again, but it was just,
it cost a bomb.
Yeah. But, and even like I took a trip to LA and everyone's like, how could you afford to clear all that music? And it was just the BBC kind of had a deal where they could use this stuff. And I felt it was just because the fact that rather than me try and, cause you know, my roots being second generation Caribbean, but at the same time, I didn't want to create something where I felt if people didn't understand certain sensibilities, that it wasn't a show for them. And at the same time, I felt like I've been able to, you know, use comedy as an oral medium and kind of give people an insight into my life and my how I see the world. But by being able to use different aesthetics and effects and colours and stuff and even music, then anything I couldn't necessarily say with script, then I could build that picture with the music anyway.
Do you know what I rate you for? The casting of your father. You picked a living legend
in, of course,
Rising Damp's own Don Warrington.
Yeah.
He's a flipping living legend.
He's a living legend to the point where it gets cringy, because when you mention him, so what happened is that people are like, oh, so you're filming? And they'd be like, I'd be like, yeah, I wrote this thing myself. And they'd be like, oh, that's pretty good. And I'd be like, did he write yourself? I'd be like, yeah. And then they'd be like, oh, shut up. Is that Don Warrington?
What did your dad say when you picked Don Warrington to essentially be him on screen?
Yeah, he was cool, man. He was real happy with it. And it's funny, because Don Warrington's son is a playwright and a comic, so I knew him as well. So I'm like, we got the same dad now. So how about that?
In your fantasy sitcom, who's your dad, Owen?
In my fantasy sitcom, it's like someone like Ray Winston. He's like nothing like my dad.
If my son was to blow off into a microphone and put on SoundCloud, I'd be well fucking proud.
You'd listen to it.
You'd love it. It'd be like whale sounds.
But to be honest, my dad's probably more like Bill Nye. My dad's Bill Nye. Amazing.
Who's your TV dad? Who's?
I would say the old Bill Cosby.
The old
Bill Cosby.
Did he have a van as well?
Version 1.
Let's say, Dr. Huxtable.
Dr. Huxtable.
Uncle Phil.
That's how you get around it.
It's funny you say Uncle Phil. You know, there's that line from that J. Cole record that really got me emotional. What's it? First thing first, rest in peace, Uncle Phil. And like, he doesn't even refer to, he just, and the next line is, you're the only father that I ever knew. Right? Now, I actually met James Avery. I met him in a lift. And it was one of those moments where you walk in and you see someone who you know, but you don't know.
Yeah.
I've grown up with this guy. And he was on crutches. I was like, what's wrong?
Yeah. Daddy, no!
But the reason I mentioned James is because my TV dad, I was so connected to, and he obviously had no idea, and he still doesn't to this day, that I got really heartbroken when I found out he had a son. Properly. I was really hurt. Will Smith.
Yeah.
When I found out about Trey, not changing, we spoke about Trey on the show a little while ago.
Trey, we love you.
Trey, we love you.
Hang in there, Trey.
Trey, we
love
you.
You're going to be
all right. We all need to send hugs to Trey.
Trey, good, man.
He's okay?
Trey's a DJ.
Trey, what happened to... Didn't you have your own production company, Trey?
I don't know.
Wasn't it like Trey Ball or something?
I don't know.
That's all right, Trey. You can do whatever you want, man. It's fine.
We love Trey. But I got really hurt when I found out that Will had Trey, because I was like,
really?
That's my dad.
Yeah, he's got a whole other family out there. You didn't even know, Reggie. You got this whole family in America this whole time.
I'm so confused. Wait, is Uncle Phil dead?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? James Avery died.
Passed away,
when?
Man.
Like about 2 years ago?
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
Oh, here's another sad fact. Well, cool fact, so it makes it sad. He was also the voice for Shredder in Teenage Turtles.
No!
Yeah.
Damn.
James Avery was the voice for Shredder. Yeah.
I did not know
that's
that.
That's how cool he was, man.
That is the coolest.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Oh, well, that's
Do you remember when you saw Jeffrey in EastEnders?
What?
Yeah, the butler.
Yeah.
Ross
Bagley was also in Brothers and Sisters on the Blouse and Skirt thing. And again, a good influence because it was juxtaposing like the kind of sitcom humour with that dry kind of British humour as well. Which made that such an amazing show. And definitely a massive, massive influence on Sunny D as well.
Do you know who lived on my road? Pork Pie.
Ram
John Holder.
I wanted him in Sunny D. He's too expensive.
Yeah.
Even now.
He was he went cheap. I mean, it's a BBC budget, man. And
that came out wrong.
The music was
too expensive.
Yeah, I kind of spent a lot of money on the music. So
but for those who haven't seen the show, I'm talking about like Jay-Z's greatest hits, Ludacris's greatest hits are all on a BBC Three sitcom. Fronted by a black dude.
Yeah.
How the hell did you get money to do that?
It was crazy. It's why negotiations for season 2 have become so difficult in stores. So people are like, first of all, Dane, that money, but the music budget is cut. Okay. First of all, you want to use some emergent acts from One Extra's unsigned. If we can do this again.
So this is where it's going for you then. Are you looking at a second season of the show?
To an extent. So at the moment, like I said, budgetary, so it's not been an immediate season 2, but we are now in the process of maybe speaking to some streaming sites in the BBC America and worldwide to maybe...
kick in.
Kick in and see how that goes. But in the meantime, I've also been working on some other sitcoms and some treatments that I'm kind of in the process of working on with some other very accredited writers. So some of the guys I'm working with wrote on Veep, which is the Emmy Award winning show, and they worked with Anando Iannucci. So it's definitely allowing me to learn a lot more. And also, another big thing about Sunny D, not the soundscape, but the casting, because I guess, you know, I was the first thing I wrote for television, first time I'd acted on television. And again, my manager had helped me source like other, I guess, black creatives to put together this amazing show where Sasha Frost played my girlfriend in the show and she hadn't done comedy acting before.
Wow.
David Ajayo and Bemi Ikumelo, who play my best friend and my sister respectively, had worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And again, I hadn't done any previous television, and Bemi had been in The Lion King and stuff, and you know, David had done a few plays. And and after doing Sunny D, like David was appearing as a regular cast member in Holby City. He's currently doing Barbershop Chronicles in Australia. And, you know, Bemi's doing TV. She's in a new sketch show called Famalam, which also is the brainchild of my cousin in Sunny D, which is Kemji Defornian. And yeah, so he's doing really well. So
Kemji's a friend.
Yeah, so Kemji's a homie as well. Time. Yeah, Kemji's cool as well, man. So yeah, just inadvertently, the show as an institution, man, like Sunny D was great in terms of allowing for, it was the first, it's been the first black majority cast sitcom on the BBC in 20 years. First of all,
Jesus.
Really? So it's been, yeah, so it's
was
20 years.
Was the last one the thing that Kemji was in? On BBC One I called
The Crouches, is it?
The Crouches.
Yeah, yes, I think it was. Yeah, so that was the last one.
20 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years ago. So yeah,
and
for a sketch show, that was 20 years ago. So it was the first one to be on the BBC since then. And then also for me, it was like, you know, Liz Hume Dawson played my mum. She's of dual heritage, so she's British and from Sierra Leone. Obviously, Don Warrington's from Trinidad. Myself being from Grenada. Sasha's parents Jamaican and English. Kemji's from Cameroon. David's Nigerian as well, and even some of the like supporting cast as well, being from like Iran. And yeah, so it was just a massive opportunity to have even diversity within diversity. Mm. Female director, female producer, female exec producer as well. So far as like making sure everybody eats, yeah, it was great. Like the working class actors and stuff. So that experience, I guess, industrially, that looked great on paper. But I was definitely... Oh, and we filmed up north, which obviously is a lot of time very obscured in a BBC project. So being able to use a very very talented northern crew as well,
yeah,
kind of made the whole thing come together. And obviously having Catherine Ryan as well, being a Canadian-Irish. So,
yeah. All the bases so covered.
They were like, Dane, we have a BBC query. I was like, I think if you take a look, all these boxes are ticked.
So that's like quota-filled three times
and then,
over.
And also Jonathan Mayer, who is a long-standing stalwart on the circuit, very talented man from Manchester, openly a gay black man, which again was a great counter-narrative to the suggestion that a heterosexual black male may be homophobic in his narrative. Mm. So we covered everything very nicely. Okay, yeah, and brought a very good cast and crew together, man. And, you know, like I said, they took a chance on me and I had never acted before. And also, yeah, Romeo was in the show too. I'll give a plot spoiler.
As in MC Romeo.
MC Romeo was in the show as well.
From So Solid Crew,
yeah, he was in the show as well. That was a hilarious exchange because I have a voice which is geared for comedy. And listening to my voice in a conversation with Romeo really reminded me of how comic my voice was.
Because he has a voice geared for lovemaking.
For lovemaking,
and
yeah,
or
yeah. He basically vibrates at a frequency
grime,
that makes
garage
ovaries travel down fallopian tubes. That's just the frequency. Like, hi, I'm Romeo. It's like, I'm pregnant. That's how he sounds. So I had to speak to him about the script and stuff, and he's just like, yeah, so this is not like some kind of mockage of like, so I was like, no, I'm a big fan. Basically, Romeo, like, I'm very excited about this, and what I'm trying to explain to you, yeah, the reason why I sound like, you know, someone trying to put a cat in a wood chipper is because I'm very excited about it. And he's like, bro, just calm down, explain to me in the scene. Because I'm speaking at the speed I'm thinking, so I'm like, so how I see you, Romeo, yeah, I'm going to use some of the lyrics, yeah, and work it in so the real fans will know like, what I'm talking about. Is yeah, oh, I understand that, bruv, like, may I say, we are doing this very good. That means a lot coming from you, because obviously back in the day, yeah, like, I would go to Colosseum.
Romeo was so cool. One of the shittest lyrics ever written, but it was amazing.
Do you remember
the skunk without a smell lyric?
Tortoise without a shell, treble without a bass.
I'm like a skunk without a smell. I'm like a tortoise without a shell.
Treble without the bass.
Treble without the bass.
Like a smell without a face.
and you'd be there going, oh. And
yeah, it'd be crazy.
And he had the audacity to remove words and repeat it. Skunk, smell, tortoise, shell, smell.
Bass, smell, face. Coffee with a kettle with a bit of the pushing. Sitting on another level. I remember the first time I actually heard it, I didn't hear him say it the first. I was on a bus and I remember these guys, they had like a tape pack.
Right.
From, because they used to be when it was on Pirate.
Yeah, it was a Gary's Delight tape.
Yeah, yeah. And the guy was like, yeah, bro, from a skunk with a shell, tortoise with a shell. And I was like, that sounds amazing. Where did he come upon these lyrics? This sounds amazing. There was like one time when like, you'd be getting on the bus and it's around the time like, so Solid were reaching prominence in like Heartless Crew, but at the same time, I think Wu-Tang Forever just dropped.
Right.
And there was a song called Triumph.
Yeah.
When it's like the whole posse cut.
Abomatomically.
Sarkozy's philosophies and hypotheses can't define, and I'll be dropping these. And every bus you got on, someone would be like, just do the beat, yeah? I know it now. Randoms all the time. And then these guys like, yeah, obviously I know it, yeah. And then in the corner I'd just be like, can't be found and I'll be dropping these. Malcolm is never to perform. I'm robbery. Play with the library, pass play, spider me, bugs got shogun. What's next? I know it, bro. Shut up. It's insane. But again, a small part of this massive influence of hearing just new creative expression. I was like, one day, if I get the chance, I want to put that in a show.
There is a lyric on the So Solid album.
Go on.
Right? It must have been an album track, wasn't a single. It goes, you want to talk about deep? I'll go deeper than the graves of the foot and mouth sheep.
tell me again for Deepak. Yeah, for Deepak.
I was
yeah.
like, wait, what the, I was like, hold on, no. hold on. There's so many questions, but all the foot and mouth sheep were burnt. They weren't put in graves.
Which is still deep, though. That mass burning of livestock is still pretty deep.
You want to talk about deep?
Like, yeah, you vegans weren't there. You don't know.
Listen, I live in South London, so I don't want at any point Mega Man or anybody from So Solid to think that we're taking a piss out of them. I don't want no smoke. But but if you revisit the lyrics from the Garage era, it's so flipping depressing.
It's crazy.
Because we were going nuts.
No, in German is nine.
Who used to say that?
I think it was Romeo again. Oh, yeah.
No, in German is nine.
But the clue is, it's in delivery. See, because then you could 2 multiplied by 10 plus 1. I mean, that was the original quick maths. Listeners, 2 multiplied. Yeah, you had your 2 plus 2 is 4. That quick maths, but we had quicker maths. Yeah. We had maths in our day too, and it was 2 multiplied by 10 plus 1, and then you were done. And so, just so you know, like, there's always been quick maths. So I just want to keep it in mind. Big up Michael Dapper as well. But yeah, Romeo was a great addition to the show. And also, I found out what it was like to be ignored on a set for an hour. Because when he came on the show and he had a very small part in the show, came for an hour, and it was like I didn't exist. And I was like, everyone remember me when I wrote this show that you're all in? So, shut up, Dave. So, Romeo, your trainers, where are they from? Everybody's fanboying out. But he was a consummate professional and... yeah, great to work with and very supportive, man. So it was an amazing experience. But yeah, the Garage thing, like I said, there was a time when it was just the vocals. It was just pretty much emceeing. Yeah. It was very early. But then, you know, DT, right?
Yeah.
Who would do the...
We're loving it.
Yeah. He got an Ivor Novello award.
No way. For that song?
I don't know what it was for.
Do you know what?
You say song, you mean those four bars where he says, we're loving
Ivor
like
Novello
this.
Is a
I know what it is, right? Owen. I definitely know. I know. I mean, I know enough about what it is to know...
You write
more stuff, but he put that on his profile, his Instagram profile on Ivor Novello. So
that's mental. At that time, every MC had to have like a call signal almost. Romeo's was oh no, it's Romeo. And Creed's was...
Yeah, nice. Nice, Owen. That was great.
And if he was feeling cocky, it was... We did win it all way.
Yeah. Still doing it.
Do you know, we got to get some old school garage.
Oh, my God.
There should be an old school garage like soundboard. You could just press the buttons and be like... Yeah, so if you have like a dance and then you can't afford the MC, so it's like... We did it.
Who is the pina colada ice cream shaker? You be the waitress, I'll be the waiter. Who is that? PSG?
PSG was bye.
No, I think PSG was that.
Yeah, PSG used to do kind of the old, him and Kai and Sparks and Kai, again, rest in peace. They would do like kind of the old school like hip-hop lyrics kind of thing and the catchphrases and stuff as well. Yeah. And then it kind of made that shift with So Solid and Heartless towards being more lyric-based.
It was such a mad era, wasn't it? Because these guys were earning... ridiculous sums of money.
Oh yeah, hell yeah.
To DJ to rooms that were, when you think about it now, imagine a club with like 5,000 people in it. Right. A nightclub.
Mm. You had Fonty at your birthday.
I had Heartless Crew at my birthday. That's my 30th birthday party.
Nice, that's how it's
David
done.
David Rodigan and Heartless Crew. It was
Rodigan and Heartless. That is how it's that's done.
That was good fun.
Yeah, my 30th birthday, I was at a Chinese restaurant on Shaftesbury Avenue and my friends were an hour and a half late. I can only give you guys the truth.
Listen, I want to go off on a tangent about garage MCs and about garage lyrics, but I think we've done our time. I think we're up. I think we're done. Listen, Dane, I can't thank you enough for coming through.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure hanging out and meeting everybody, man. It's been fun, man.
I think it's only fair for those who follow either you or me on social media to be open about how this actually came about. And that was, even though we have each other's numbers, you messaged me on my post showing Ramesh.
Jamali. It was Jamali.
On the Jamali post. And you left a comment going, when can I come to the Trap House?
I like Trap Houses in South London. Why can't I come? There's a comedy Trap House. I want to be there too. That's cool.
And now you are.
I am, man. It's been an absolute pleasure, man. And thanks for the support. And yeah, guys, everyone here as well, you want to come down in a sex van? Then you do that, Owen. Everyone's welcome. So my show New show this year is Gold, Oil and Drugs, and it's at the 28th of May to the 2nd of June at the Soho Theatre. So yeah, please do come down. And yeah, and also check out Sunny D as well, man. Again, thank you very much for having me.
And as someone who actually went down to see Reasonable Doubt at the Soho Theatre, I encourage you to see this man live, because yeah, Apollo, great, but when you go to see this man in the Soho Theatre, which is the perfect size for comedy, you'll really enjoy it. Dane, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me, man. Pleasure.
So that is that. That is the end of series one of Talk Stew. It's been emotional. We've had some fantastic guests. We've had a lot of laughs. We've had some good moments to cherish and think about for the rest of our lives. but if you're one of the people that has subscribed or given us 5 stars or told a mate or even sent a message on social media about the show, it's really appreciated. We should be back. So in theory, we're going to take a little break, and we'll see you soon for series two. Thanks for listening to Talk Stew.
Deezer. Originals.